Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Companies and market show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Megan Boxall. How are you doing, Megan?
Very well, thanks, John.
Good. And Harriet Clarford, how are you, Harriet?
I'm fine, thank you.
I don't think we've been in a room together in the podcast.
I don't think we have. I think it's the first time.
Excellent. Well, you've written the cover page this week, and it's a great feature.
Oh, thank you.
How did it go?
It was really interesting to write, actually. I learned a lot of stuff myself.
What's it about?
So it's basically about a range of emergent and developmental technology. Developmental? That's not a word.
We'll go with developmental.
Developmental stages. They're technologies which you might have read about in the past sort of decade or so, I'd say. So examples are artificial intelligence, virtual reality and 3D printing.
And these technologies are all coming to... They're gathering momentum right
and
now.
And I think what we've kind of seen is that they're almost reaching a tipping point now. So a lot of companies, large and small around the world, are now buying into these technologies in a big way.
Okay, we'll talk about this in a minute when we get past the news. So you, Megan, have been looking after the news section this week in Emma's absence. What's been going on? You've written it, most of it, as well.
I did write a little bit of it as well. There's been a lot of takeover stuff this week, which is the other thing that I look after in the magazine. And it's been all very interesting. So
right, what's going on?
Well, we've had Aldermore, who have had a potential takeover offer. They had a lot of extremely exciting share price movement this week.
So Aldermore is a challenger bank.
Challenger bank, yeah. So this would be the third challenger bank to be taken private this year if the acquisition does go through. It's been approached by a South African company. So that's quite interesting.
Tell It, you've written about as well
Tell It,
in the
we've
main
about
story.
A lot, yeah, we've written about that a lot recently. But again, that's had sort of murmurings of potential takeover. The share price has been hammered recently. And I mean, if it's going to be bought, now's going to be a good time for it to be bought.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. And then we also had Revolution Bars, which has been massive takeover story.
I mean, this is, in terms of Revolution Bars and their approach to takeovers, this looks like a guy that's gone to a party.
Yeah, it sounds like the decision. All the meetings have happened.
Didn't fancy that one, and has ended up with no one.
With nothing, exactly. Yeah. Revolution Bars had a profit warning a few months ago, and soon after the profit warning, it was approached by Stonegate Pub Group, which owns like a Slug and Lettuce. Clearly, the CEO of Revolution Bars thought, "Yeah, we like the look of that. We fit nicely into their business." So Stonegate were offering 203 pence per share in cash for the acquisition. The management were all over it, how we're having that. And then...
And they got some other offers on the way.
And then another offer came along from Deltic, which owns a load of, like, dodgy old nightclubs. Deltic's offer was an all-share offer. And management were just, for some reason, very against that. And it was quite hard to work out the exact value of the deal because Deltic is not a listed company. And they were offering...
What do they own?
Prism.
Nightclubs. What are they? I don't even know them. I mean,
they're loads of different chains of nightclubs. Oceana is another one.
It's a perfect fit for Revolution Bars, you would have thought.
The management, this is like pure speculation, but management seem to have been going for the whole like premium look. We are a nice chain of bars. This is Revolution Bars. So when the opportunity from Deltic came along, and they're all a little bit seedy, I don't know, maybe it was an image thing that management was really against that, even though the offer actually looked quite good. But that offer was never accepted, and Deltic said we're not willing to work with management, so they withdrew their offer, and shareholders got to vote on the Stonegate offer, but shareholders voted against it, potentially because there was that other Deltic one floating around. I mean...
Is that what it is? Did they vote against it because they thought they could get a better price?
Yeah, because there was, I think there was quite a lot of speculation that the share price, the offer could be pushed higher. The share price was actually above the offer price for a long time in the last few weeks. But now it's completely fallen through, and Stonegate, under the takeover code, aren't going to be allowed to make another approach for 12 months. Deltek, also under takeover code, can't make another approach for another 6 months. But surprisingly, Revolution Bar's share price has really not fallen very far at all, considering how low it was before the offer was made. So, I mean, shareholders seem pretty happy, but he's gone.
What are we saying, though?
We are saying hold for the moment. Just hold on. We actually advised shareholders not to accept the offer.
Oh, so we're partly responsible then.
It's our fault.
For this fiasco.
Well, I'd like to think so. Because we were saying wait and see whether Deltek makes a formal offer, because they actually looked like they were being more generous.
And one thing I do remember, I can't remember the name of the company. I wish I'd looked into it beforehand. There was a listed nightclubs group on the London Stock Exchange a number of years ago, and it didn't end well.
Oh, really?
No.
Interesting. So, yeah, so maybe that Deltek was going to try and reverse into Revolution Bar, so they would have kept the AIM listing, and so it would have been a much larger company.
No, they're full market. They're main market.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, they are, yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah, no, main market. Had a long trading record, so.
Would have kept their FTSE listing.
Yeah,
Oh, okay.
No, that one always catches me out as well. Yeah. You would have thought, you know, it's the kind of company you would expect to be on AIM, but yeah. No, it's main market. Pretty sure of it.
Okay.
You talk about the takeover code.
Yes.
So let's talk about the takeover code, because there are rumblings that the takeover code is going to change
in
the months ahead.
Interesting, yeah. So Greg Clark, who is the Business and Energy Secretary, he came out this week with proposals that the government can have a little bit more input into takeovers of any size. And I know
I
how much
see you grinning,
Megan. It's interesting because there have been so many takeovers which have raised eyebrows recently.
For a long time.
Yeah, for a very long time. So Arm was one last year. It was the first sort of big company to go when after Theresa May became Prime Minister.
Yep.
A lot of people said, Theresa May was very, very pro keeping our tech companies, our biotech and our pharma companies in the UK. So when Arm went, people were a bit like...
What I will say is Arm didn't go.
No.
I mean, Arm was... The ownership of Arm changed, but Arm is still very much in the UK. And one of the things that SoftBank said when it bought Arm was that it would continue to invest in its UK business.
Yeah, which
and
is
it has
good.
Done. And
yeah,
it has done.
It has. But, I mean, you can also make the argument that just saying that... I mean, they didn't sign anything. There wasn't anything. Part of the contract was, we are definitely going to keep these jobs in Cambridge.
So is that what it's about? I mean, is it putting some structure around the promises that foreign predators make when they're buying companies?
I think that is the sort of thing. I mean, when Pfizer and AstraZeneca was sort of coming for AstraZeneca, there was a lot of concern that all those pharmaceutical jobs, which are now in Cambridge for AstraZeneca, would be lost to the US. People would have to move. And you do see it quite a lot with companies that do shift their operations to the US or manufacturing to China.
I think I've said to you before, I think this all goes back to, I mean, it goes, you know, it's a long-running saga in the UK, but the Cadbury was the big one. And the takeover by Kraft, where they promised to keep jobs in the UK and then basically didn't.
Yeah. And a whole town was lost. Bournville. No,
Bournville's still there.
Yeah, but it's
there's property. Have you seen? I mean, Bournville's lovely.
Yeah, but there's not really.
But there's no factory there.
Yeah, there aren't any jobs in Bournville anymore, apart from working at the Cadbury.
I think the actual factories that were the problem were in Bristol. I think Keynsham. I think they were. But yes. I mean, what is this about? I mean, we have philosophical debates about this. My view is that companies should run themselves as they feel fit.
Yeah, and we have said that about this week about these two potential offers, Teller and Aldermore. If the offer price is right, then I mean that's great for investors. But I think that the wider picture is actually great for the UK economy to be having companies, all of our companies, being run by overseas investors. The growth in British tech and pharmaceuticals.
I kind of understand this argument. I understand that this is something that seems, on the face of it, something needs to be done. We need to keep British companies British.
Yeah, but that's a sentiment which I don't like. That's just like the same sort of argument.
But tell it's not a British company anyway. No, we've talked about that. I mean, you know, AIM is, you know, AIM is an international market. In fact, the UK stock market is an international market. That's the point of London. That's why London is successful, because we are a hub of international capital. And, you know, we can't think like this.
Yeah.
If we want to continue to be a hub of international capital.
And that is actually what that some, I can't remember who it was saying, like, we shouldn't be thinking about foreign takeovers. There isn't actually, I mean, in today and age, there isn't really a foreign takeover. Everyone's trading with all the different countries. Everyone's buying in China, selling in America. Everyone's trading around the world globally. So really...
I mean, it does make for a complicated question.
Yeah.
Especially, but I mean, generally speaking, I would say that this question goes back to protecting British jobs. Mm. I mean, that's the one thing British politicians actually care about, is protecting British jobs. And obviously, Cadbury was an example where that didn't happen. Mm. But in the case of ARM, it has happened.
Yeah.
They have kept British jobs, and they've actually made some more jobs too. Mm-hmm. You know, think about the British car industry. What is our car industry? I mean, it's a conglomeration of foreign interests who have factories in the UK, BMW, Nissan. You know, so I just don't get the argument that you need to protect these companies.
Well, we're going to try and have this debate in another podcast at some point.
We are. It's one of my favourite ongoing debates. I love it.
And hopefully we'll get someone in who has a very strong opposing view to yours, and we'll have a nice debate about it.
Well, I look forward to speaking to John McDonnell on the podcast. It's time. Right, let's talk about what else is going on in the news. Let's go to the tip updates for Convatec, because you tipped this as a sell a few weeks back, and what your concerns have perhaps become more tangible quickly than you expected them.
Definitely. I mean, it's kind of been... It hasn't been doing well since the summer, Convatec. It had a great IPO.
Tell us what they do before we...
Convatec, it's not a fun company to talk about.
Wound care.
Colostomy bags, like stuff, that kind of nasty stuff.
Important stuff, though.
Like the kind of thing that could be a fantastic business, because the market's growing. We've got an aging population, we've got a growing population. And it's also, like, these are repeat consumables. You don't just buy one colostomy bag, you buy... lots. I mean, it should be a great business. And Smith & Nephew is an example of another one of these companies on the LSE, which has done incredibly well.
Doing very well.
Yeah, really, really well. Growth has been amazing, sensible, like investing in the product pipeline.
Isn't Smith & Nephew much more around the actual replacement joints, as it were?
Yeah, they did have that.
Knees, pips, etc., etc.
Yeah, but it's a similar sort of business model. I mean, it's healthcare consumables. It's not drugs, it's medical equipment. And so I think that was why there was quite a lot of optimism around Convatec when it came to the market last year. It was floated by private equity, who had bought it from Bristol Myers Squibb a few years before. And they came to the market with a load of debt, which they raised a bit of money and then they refinanced their debt as well. But they've still got a load of debt. And the growth is just—it's just not there. And
what's going wrong, though? I mean, as you say, I mean, these are markets that you would expect, given the demographic trends that we are seeing. Mm. I mean, this should be a slam dunk for them, surely.
Yeah, it should. But I think what the problem seems to be is that they're not a market leader. They're in any of their industries, so. Because they're always fighting, there's so much competition, but they haven't really invested as much in their product pipeline as competitors have. So,
do you think that's partly because of where it's come from in terms of its ownership before it's become a publicly traded company?
Yeah, and it just seems to be that they've been paying these ridiculous finance costs for a very long time. They have been absorbing a lot of the money that Convatec makes, rather than actually investing in growth.
Mm.
So because they haven't invested in their actual products, they're just not as good, and they're being outcompeted by bigger companies, including Smith & Nephew, and then there's another one in the US called Coloplast, which is a massive company. It's doing really well. They're struggling to compete. Because they're struggling to compete, now they're having to try and invest a bit more, but that's not working.
Is it going to be enough to turn around?
It's not really.
Perhaps it's been a serial underinvestment for a number of years.
Yeah, I think it has been for a long time. And now they seem to be doing silly things which are all mistimed. Like they've moved they're trying to cut out costs by moving their manufacturing from the US to the Dominican Republic. But in doing so, they've done it really slowly. So they've lost a load of contracts with hospitals because you can't wait for your supply of colostomy bags. You have to have it now. So people have changed
this conversation.
Their...
worse, worse. Carry on, Megan.
People, so they've lost a load of business because of these product delays.
Understandably.
Yeah, and then so I mean that's business that's not coming back, is it? You've lost the trust of your customer. That bit of business is gone, and they're spending so much money. Their profits are not looking good. Their margins are contracting. When they said they were widening about 6 months ago, I mean, everything is just going horribly wrong.
We've got them on a sale still, haven't we?
We have. And also the other thing is the private equity owners, they're just selling. They're selling out. They held about 20% still when they came to the market.
Which is actually not a large amount for a private equity house to have when they flip something onto the market.
Yeah, but now they have about 4%. Well, one of the owners is about 4%, one has about 12%. And
it's not been on the market very long, has it?
So they've sold down
quite quickly.
Yeah, they've sold down really quickly. And now the demand just doesn't seem to be there for those big chunks of shares.
I mean, this goes back to a feature we wrote a few weeks ago, Julia Forshaw's IPO feature, which talks about private equity.
Yeah.
Public, you know, private to public transition. Some of them actually work quite well. This seems to be a classic example of one that's done very, very badly.
Yeah. So yeah, sell Convatec.
Wow. Okay. I mean, talking of big trends, and I think the demographic transitions that we're seeing right now are one of the biggest trends that we have to contend with. But Harriet, you this week in your cover feature are looking at some other trends which. Are big trends too, really big trends.
They are. And I mean, as I said, they're emergent and some people might not necessarily have envisaged that they were going to sort of come to the fore as quickly as they have. But I think we are really seeing that trends like artificial intelligence and virtual reality are actually potentially going to underpin a lot of industries in the future.
Yeah, there was a guy on a news night this week talking about how, I mean, there was a lot of concern around how our AI is going to destroy jobs. You know, and actually, as some of you may know, I've just done a degree about this very subject. And these concerns were to the fore in the 1970s as well, that robotics were going to basically devastate industry. But it's not proved. That's not proved the case necessarily.
Not so far, no. And I think, I mean, robotics. You know, people are using robotics and automation more and more, and you know, and both of those are underpinned by AI. But I think for the time being, we still need people to sort of use those robotics. We need people there to kind of oversee what's going on. I think.
So what you're saying then is that. Whilst these technologies exist, it's actually about how they complement a workflow, as it were, rather than replacing it.
So I think using Blue Prism as an example, Blue Prism is a company which supplies what they call software robots, which sort of help with back office functions. And I think the idea there is that tasks which are quite manual and rules based can actually be carried out by a computer just as well as a human employee. And I suppose my understanding of it is that then the human employee would be able to do something else with their time. Although,
not work.
Yeah, maybe. Or sort of be more creative with their skills in a way that a robot wouldn't be able to be. But I think more and more as we see automation taking off in factories, for example, I mean, in the future, we talk about ASOS and Boohoo as examples of companies with automated factories.
And Ocado as well, isn't it?
Ocado has sort of automated fulfillment centres.
But I mean, you talk about Ocado in your feature. It's not really worked out from a shareholder's perspective. It's not, you know, these amazingly sophisticated warehouses have not translated into shareholder gains.
No, and you watch videos of Ocado's technology and it's pretty unbelievable when you see how automated their fulfillment centres really are. But no, so far, I mean, when I wrote the feature, it was one of the most shorted stocks on the UK market, and I'm not sure, I imagine it's probably still the case. And it hasn't really transpired.
It's never been a favourite of mine.
No, well, I also
as
think
a consumer, it's great.
As a consumer, it's great.
But I don't care whether you know whatever's in my shopping bag has been packed by a computer or a human being. I don't give a monkey.
Yeah, but it's going to get there quicker and cheaper because it's being packed by a robot.
It's not any cheaper though. It's just the same food, the same price. It gets to my house at the same time. You know, I don't care whether it's a man.
The service is so much better for Ocado than it is for like Tesco home delivery.
Yeah.
Well, you have a lot more oversight of where your order is, and where you can log on and see every stage of your deliveries.
And you can book specific slots.
Why is this not translating into profits?
One of the things that I've looked at in the future is actually kind of first mover advantage. And I think with Ocado, it might be the case that it has paved the way for other companies to copy what it's doing, but better. So Ocado, I mean, it looks really interesting. It actually has a platform called Ocado Technology, which kind of...
Which it's trying to sell to other people
exactly.
Well. And not having much success with that, really.
No, not really. And I think, you know, at the same time, we have companies in America like Amazon, which is, I think, testing grocery delivery. And you can kind of see how they might do what Ocado's doing, but on a much greater scale internationally. And then they'll... Companies like Ocado will kind of be squeezed out.
Mm. No,
can't really see the potential for it.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah,
Harriet, tell me about your favourite technology that you've looked at in this feature. Which is the one you look at and think, just wow?
I have to say, I mean, I thought it would be virtual reality because I think that's a really exciting prospect. But I think
as far as I understand, the virtual reality, I mean, the main application of that is sticking a headset on when you get on a roller coaster.
Yeah, just... I mean, I know that just doesn't blow my mind.
No.
Apparently, it is mind blowing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I need to try this.
So you thought VR was the one,
and I would say just to that point, although yeah, I think everyone thinks of virtual reality and thinks it's what gamers do when they're sitting at home on the computer, or when you want to try a roller coaster, you put a headset on instead. But there are actually loads of other applications. So one of the companies we've looked at and we've written about a bit before is EVR Holdings, which provides virtual reality music content. You can kind of go to a concert, but from your sofa at home.
Dude, that sounds so rubbish.
It sounds awful. it's just going to ruin everything.
I mean,
no one's
going to
do anything.
Sure.
Have you seen WALL-E?
Oh yeah.
Oh, you sit in your fat chair, and
you just sit there. You don't do anything. You never leave your chair. You don't speak to anyone face to face because everything's on a screen. If that's the future, then people need to stop with all this virtual reality nonsense.
Virtual reality also kind of transcends the entertainment market. Although I do think that will be a really interesting kind of burgeoning area. The other kind of areas we've looked at are defence training, education, the sorts of companies you might not exactly think would engage with virtual reality and also augmented reality, but we looked at Pennant, for example, which uses virtual reality simulation.
Yeah, Pennant, tell me about them. Well, I mean, that's a UK company.
It's a UK
Pennant
company.
International. What do they do?
So they're a sort of defence company, and one of the areas that they specialise in now is virtual reality defence training software.
Oh, God, this is the technology. Parachute. This is the parachutes, isn't it?
So they have one of their examples is a virtual reality parachute simulation.
3D printing is the one I'm really interested in.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. I think that's probably the one I found most interesting, just because I'd kind of read about it a little bit here and there, but I hadn't really fully understood how much it could sort of penetrate lots of different markets. In the US, there are a couple of major players. So 3D Systems is one, and I think that they're one of the sort of originators of 3D printing. But then there's also Stratasys in the US.
We've got one in the UK as well.
We've got one in the UK. I mean, we actually have a few private companies as well, but XAR, which is spelled XAAR, they've been developing their sort of 3D printing business. And one of the areas they particularly specialise in is high-speed sintering, which I'm not going to try to explain because I'll probably do it badly, but it's a sort of more advanced version of 3D printing, which uses a sort of powder layer.
What do you need to do that's more advanced than 3D printing?
You can make trainers out of this stuff, which is the example we put in the magazine.
Exactly. So you can make special structured heels for trainers. And I mean, I think high-speed sintering is meant to be able to bring 3D printing into mass production. I think that's really what a lot of people have been waiting for. We've read a lot about 3D printing, but when is it actually going to affect everyone around the world and not just sort of major industrial players?
And I think a really important point to note, which we don't really go into in the feature because it's too big to even comprehend, but this could change like the entire basis of like import, export and, the way that goods move around the world. If you don't need to make a pair of trainers in China because you can print it at home. You're going to do that.
And that, I mean, there may come a day, I'm not sure if it'll be in the immediate future, but when people really can order something online and print it at home, I think, you know, in the sort of more immediate future, it might be that shops can print off their stock using 3D printers or, you know, local warehouses can. But I think it can, and it may well massively impact cross-border trade.
I mean, certainly for things like, car parts, for example, it's already happening.
And we did. I mean, there was a report quite recently from ING which looked exactly at this. And they said that, I think it was in the year 2060, the automotive industry will be massively affected potentially by 3D printing. And the big suppliers of car parts and of whole cars might find that countries are able to print them themselves.
It's amazing. I mean, it really does have huge implications for the things that we're discussing now around Brexit and the trade deals that we're... I mean, it really does.
Maybe we won't need trade deals.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
That's not the first time I've heard that said. Maybe the future means we don't need trade deals. The way that technology is evolving means we won't need trade deals in the way that they've historically been structured. We call the feature the New Industrial Revolution, which is not as good as your title. Harrods, which I really liked, but it just didn't work with the image. Great text expectations.
I was an English grad, I think.
You like a bit of Dickens.
Yeah, exactly.
I like a bit of Dickens too.
Great text expectations. But I think, I mean, one of the points we kind of make in the future is that there are expectations, but they're actually already here, a lot of these technologies. So.
It's really good. Thank you very much. I really enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
And now I think it's time to head over to Simon Thompson, who's on the telephone. How are you doing, Simon?
I'm doing really well, John. Had a cracking week. Produced an online column for readers online only, hitting target prices. It's well worth a read. 3,000 words of analysis.
Well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
I would. I found out an amazing thing. That one of the companies, BP Marsh & Partners, cash-rich insurance sector investment company, I've been following it for a few years, and they beat my forecast. I do the modelling on it, so I had the board of directors on the phone.
What do you mean you do the modelling? From scratch? Bottom up?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's hardly any analyst coverage, and they don't actually predict net asset value or anything like that. So I go through each individual company and actually work out what the revaluations will be. And I was predicting that NAV would be heading towards £3 a share.
Simon, that makes you an analyst, not a journalist.
I'm both, John. you're lucky to have me.
So you keep telling me.
Absolutely.
So what do we like about BP Marsh? I mean, they beat the numbers, but I mean, let's put some meat on the bones of that story.
There's more meat on the bones because two companies which account for half the net asset value. There's news that's not actually in the price. One of them is an independent financial advisory firm, LEVC, that has been growing at an incredible rate of knots. That's partly RDR, but also it's been winning major corporate contracts as well. And I've heard on the grapevine that they're in the running for what could be a massive contract and a material one for their profits. I mean, the profits are going incredibly well. They trebled to 2.1 million in the last 3 years to September 2016. And, you know, they could easily do another 25, 30% for the year just ended. That company's trading at a pretty big discount to Mattioli Woods, which is the listed rival. So when you do a valuation in the accounts for BP Marsh. So, I mean, that's one. The other one is Nexus Underwriting. It accounts for about 20% of their net asset value. And their cash profits are forecast, I understand, from management there. The cash profits are expected to rise to about £11 million compared with 2.6 back in 2014. Well, it's got an enterprise value of only £123 million. So that puts it on a 11 times enterprise value to cash profit multiple.
So let's boil this down to the hard question, Simon. Well, the pounds and pence of a share price. What's the upside?
Share price now is £2.60, which was initially my target price. I put the readers in at the start at 80 odd pence, and I've kept us a buy ever since. It's got to be in excess of £3. I mean, the NAV now is £3. I can see the next set of results, another 10, 11, 12% growth in NAV easily. It's just going one way. There's a dividend. And also, every time the share price drops, more than 25% below net asset value, they go into the market and buy shares. So you've got a...
Almost like an investment trust. Almost like an investment trust, basically.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's well underpinned. It's a quality company. They're doing the right things. They've generated some thumping returns on capital on some of the companies they've actually sold or investments they've sold. So, I mean, that's one. That's an online-only article.
I do like these little investment groups. There are a number of them about, and you tend to pay attention to them because obviously that's where there is a potential for significant mispricing. But yeah, here's another. Love it.
They're just not covered well by analysts. So yeah. You can actually, and myself obviously, but other investors can go in, do the number crunching themselves, get the edge over other investors, and then when the good news hits the wires, you know, you'll see a re-rating.
Excellent.
So I mean, there's another two companies, Easy Hotel and Elegant Hotels, in the article. They're well worth reading. But
so I mean, let's turn to the magazine article, Simon, which is about property.
So a trio of property plays. My thinking here is that even if the Bank of England increase interest rates belatedly, I should add.
And by a very small amount also.
Well, exactly, at next month's meeting. There is no way that rates are going to increase any other way than very small amounts in the future. And the most important thing for property companies and house builders and people who pay mortgages is the swap rate market. So that's basically priced off the yield curve, government gilts. And I just can't see any material change in the yield curve going forward. So,
do you know what? It's funny you mention that. I mean, we do track the yield curve in the magazine, and it was bouncing all over the place for a number of years. It's all gravitating towards like one line, basically. Like where we were 3 months ago, where we were 12 months ago, it's literally consolidating in one line and not changing very much.
Well, exactly. And that's despite the fact that we already know that Mark Carney has basically told us that, you know, there's a very good chance interest rates will actually rise next month. But people are actually taking the sensible approach that, you know, it's going to be small increments and, you know, cheap borrowing is going to be here for quite some time. So, I mean, that's got implications for the house building sector. And I put readers into Telford Homes, East London House Builder, just after Brexit last year, when they were very anomalously priced.
Was this after the huge sell-off then?
Yeah. So I mean, the share price was £2.89. It's now £4 now. Even at £4, the shares are trading about 9.5 times earnings for the current financial year. The most important thing to remember here is that they've been de-risking their forward sales. They've got a forward order book of 580 million quid. That equates to about 70% of forecast sales over the next two financial years. It's on track to increase its profits. And this is guidance from management, by the way, by 15% to £40 million in the current financial year. Analysts are actually going for more than that. Peel Hunt, Gavin Gago, the analyst there, expects another 10% on top of that, £40 million PBT, implying earnings per share of about 47 pence, share price £4. So that's your 9.5, 9 times earnings rating. There's a decent dividend yield as well. I mean, they're looking at about 17 pence worth of dividends this year, so the yield is over 4%. Mm. But you then look at the forwards pipeline and you segment it and think, well, you know, how sound is it? Well, they've got 500 build-to-rent homes with a gross development value of £236 million in that pipeline.
The build-to-rent stuff, yeah, Jonas has been writing about this quite a lot. It's a very interesting move for them. I think it's a very interesting move generally, given the trends in the property market.
Well, the thing is, you get a big insurance company like Legal & General or Aviva on board, and they basically buy the land, fund the development, so there's no development loans for Telford on these 500 build-to-rent homes. That then has implications for its gearing levels, has implications for its return on capital, which is going to be higher because of the lack of borrowings. You know, net debt for Telford Homes at the end of March was only £14 million. I mean, that was, you know, 7% of shareholders' funds. It's nothing. You've basically got blue-chip institutions that are backing these developments, and they're basically guaranteed.
Indeed. I mean, the house building question is one we've asked on the magazine a number of times. I mean, this momentum trade has just continued and continued, apart from the Brexit wobble. I mean, we've got Bellway results in the magazine this week. That share price graph is a pretty straight upward line. You know, the special dividends are fat. The profits are ticking up. I mean, the house building sector, it's just flying.
Absolutely. And, you know, you also got to bear in mind that my favoured first quarter house building trade is just around the corner as well.
Ooh, I can't wait, Simon.
Yeah. Well, let's see what the share prices are like come the end of December, John.
But it hasn't failed for a while, has it?
No, it's a standing dish in the stock market. It's just absolutely incredible.
Hey, talking of the house building trade, that was one of the trades in your was it your last book or your first book? I can't remember which one now. So many books, Simon.
It was the first book, John.
And you're going to be going to write another one, aren't you?
I'm going to be taking part of November and most of December off in order to write my next book. So that will be hitting the shops next year.
Can you give us any clues where you're heading with this one?
It's going to be very interesting indeed.
That's not a clue, so.
Well, all I can say is if you like the last two, then you're going to like the next one as well. So I've just got to put pen to paper. So that's something for early next year.
Excellent. Look forward to it. Absolutely. Simon, thank you very much. We'll catch up again next week.
Brilliant. Great.
Cheers,
talk.
Simon.
Cheers.
Okay. So thank you, Simon. Simon is prolific, as I'm sure you're all aware. And there's lots more on the website, lots more in the magazine, lots of ideas there. Thank you, of course, to Harriet and to Megan for their contributions today. We've barely touched the size of that feature. It's absolutely huge. And Megan has written so much this week. And it actually is really a quiet week for us, because we're winding down on the results front. But plenty more in the magazine. Philip Ryland has resumed his 50 objects. We're on number 41. And we're counting down to 50 for the rest of the year. 50 objects that have shaped the world of finance as we know it. Lots more in the magazine. Lots in the personal finance and fun section. Leonora's back, and they'll be talking about that tomorrow. Lots in the comment section as usual. Thank you very much for listening. Pick up the magazine, All Good News Agents, The New Industrial Revolution, which is what it really is. £4.90. See you later.